This is Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, we'll hear what the governor proposed in his budget address this week. He offered up a plan, but some of the money is contingent on voters changing the state constitution. The city of Peoria has a program where police officers live in high-crime neighborhoods and build relationships with residents.
Oddly enough, when we first put a resident officer in the area, we will actually notice after the first few months that the calls for service will increase in those areas. But that's a good thing because that's showing that the community is putting more trust into the police.
We'll learn more about that program. Also, physical education used to be about the body, but gym classes are now considering mental health as well. And how did some couples show their love on Valentine's Day? By getting a tattoo. Those stories and more this hour on Statewide. Welcome to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way this hour, we'll get a ground-level view of a resident police officer program in one city. Also, there's more of an effort to test rural water supplies. And later, we'll hear from some of the Republican candidates running to take on Democratic U.S. Senator Dick Durbin this fall. That and more coming up on Statewide. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker is already making plans to spend money from a significant change in the state income tax, even though that can only happen if voters agree to amend the Illinois Constitution this November. Pritzker delivered his annual budget proposal to the General Assembly on Wednesday, and as Brian Mackey reports, a significant chunk of it depends on the governor's graduated income tax.
When figuring out what sort of spending plan to present to the General Assembly, governors are constrained. They're not supposed to base their plans on tax increases that may or may not happen. But Pritzker has made a tax increase a central goal of his administration. Last year, he and his fellow Democrats proposed a graduated income tax for Illinois, where wealthier people would pay a higher rate. The problem for Pritzker is, in order for that to happen, Illinois voters would have to agree to change the Illinois Constitution at this fall's election, so any extra tax money that would be generated is speculative. Because of that, Pritzker used his budget address to make a case for a graduated income tax.
No amount of wishful thinking will wave away our structural deficit or our pension obligations. No amount of lip service will balance the budget or fund our schools or improve public safety.
Pritzker laid out all the areas where he thinks the state should spend more money, but only if the graduated income tax goes through. This contingent spending, the administration calls it a reserve, totals about $1.5 billion.
Because this reserve is so large, it inevitably cuts into some of the things that we all hold most dear. Increased funding for K-12 education, universities and community colleges, public safety, and other key investments.
Among the spending Pritzker says would be held back until after the election is money for a new class of state troopers, a 5% increase in operating money for universities, and a big chunk of an annual increase in education funding. That last one was part of a multi-year bipartisan effort to bring more equity to state schools, bridging the gap between rich and poor districts. The thing is, that increase is set in law, and the idea of making it subject to the whim of voters rubbed some lawmakers the wrong way.
We had school funding reform. The idea of school funding reform is that we would always appropriate what's by statute. I think we should do that.
Democratic State Senator Christina Castro from Elgin says it's early in the process and there's room for negotiation, but
we're going to work fairly diligently to make sure everything is done the way it should be.
And not all of Pritzker's $1.5 billion reserve is optional spending. It also includes hundreds of millions of dollars for corporate income tax refunds and state worker health care.
We're still going to accrue those liabilities.
State Representative Tom Demmer is a Republican from Dixon.
State employees are still going to go to the doctor in fiscal year 21. The difference is the governor is saying that if the tax increase doesn't pass, he's not going to pay them. And that's exactly the kind of problem that led us to have ballooning unpaid bill backlog. And he's proposing to go right back into that playbook.
Republicans also say this approach is unnecessary. House Republican leader Jim Durkin of Western Springs says the economy is strong, unemployment is low, and the state should be able to balance its budget without having to reach into taxpayers' pockets.
We don't feel that we have to have a budget that is going to be conditioned upon this pixie dust that is spreading through the Capitol on this constitutional amendment. It's just not right.
Returning to the speech, Pritzker would probably appreciate the Republicans' acknowledgement that the economy is doing okay.
It's become something of a political sport in this state over the last several years to present our fiscal issues as insurmountable.
Pritzker says yes, the budget challenges are hard, and yes, Illinois government is more complicated. But
our future will not be built on the shaky rhetorical foundation of those who keep rooting for us to fail.
In other words, if Illinois wants to live its best life, at least from a fiscal perspective, it's time to knock off the negative self-talk. I'm Brian Mackey.
Some pet owners in Illinois have had to choose between keeping their pet or staying in a place they can afford. State Senator Linda Holmes, an Aurora Democrat, has introduced legislation that would require affordable housing landlords to allow pets. Shoshana Mosteler with the Belleville Area Humane Society says the measure could reduce the burden on shelters.
We're trying to find homes for homeless animals, and 38% of our requests are from animals that already have homes, already have loving homes. You watch the people bring in their pet, and they're crying, they're upset.
Landlords and property owners who receive tax subsidies for low-income housing would be required to allow tenants to keep common pets, and that would include domesticated cats and dogs, regardless of size, weight, or breed. A handful of Peoria police are working double duty as patrolmen and neighbors. The Resident Officer Program places police in high-risk neighborhoods to deter crime and build relationships with others who live there. There are four in the city, and there are plans to add another. Dana Vollmer with WCBU recently rode along with the newest officer participating in the program.
Hello, how you
good
doing?
Morning.
Doing pretty good. How
morning.
Y'all doing?
I'm Officer James with Peoria Police Department, new resident officer here on the corner of Wisconsin, Nebraska.
This is a routine call for Officer Jerry James Jr. He's following up on a report of a home that might not have heat. James is with a city inspector to make sure the residents are safe. They also brought information on how to get help covering heating costs. Before he leaves, James hands the homeowner a business card and tells her to call or text anytime.
I get a chance to make myself known to her. So, you know, like I said, this encounter was nothing negative. You know, it wasn't, hey, the police are here, you're in trouble. No, it's, hey, here we are. There was a complaint of welfare check, but now we're here to offer any assistance as needed. And then it gives me a chance to kind of get an idea of the whole story. North 10, 10-8. Show me out at 712 East Arcadia, follow up.
At James's next stop, a few blocks over, he's checking in on a resident whose car was stolen a week before. Flora Randall has rented this home on Arcadia for 16 years. She has recently dealt with a rash of crimes, break-ins, slashed tires, and that same morning, a torn yard sign. Randall says she appreciates how kind James has been to her.
I feel more secure for a person, an officer, to come and check up on you and find out, you know, how I'm doing, because this area, it used to be a nice area, but now these young kids have taken over and do what they want, especially to the older people that lives here. They seem not to give them no respect at all.
Back in the squad car, James says he sees his job as making the East Bluff feel like home again for residents like Randall.
You know, I know as times have changed and the neighborhood's changed, you know, some people are like, well, if you know you don't like, you leave. But how do you tell someone that's lived their entire life here, you know, to leave? I'm saying no, you know, you have every right to stay here.
The city started embedding cops in neighborhoods 7 years ago. The department places resident officers in high crime areas. The idea is just having an officer nearby will deter crime, and living there will help build rapport with people in the area. Peoria Police Chief Lauren Marion says it's difficult to quantify how well the program builds trust. He says there are a few measures of success.
Oddly enough, when we first put a resident officer in the area, we will actually notice after the first few months that the calls for service will increase in those areas. But that's a good thing, because that's showing that the community is putting more trust into the police.
Marion says call volume eventually drops as community members turn directly to the resident officer for help with things like barking dogs, noisy neighbors, and property line issues. He also says large crowds at community events hosted by resident officers are a sign outreach efforts work. Marion says serious crime has dropped in all four neighborhoods with a resident officer. He says some declines are larger than others.
within that resident officer area on the West Bluff, a 59% decrease of crimes against person. So that's your batteries, assaults, robberies, stuff like that. Southside only had, it had a minimal decrease, but only 4.9%.
Some academics doubt these numbers tell the whole story.
It was really interesting to me that there's no like scholarly studies or data that really evaluates how effective these programs are, especially since some of them have been around since like the early 1990s.
That's Professor Ashley Farmer. She teaches criminal justice and studies community policing at Illinois State University.
What we know about them pretty much comes from police departments themselves saying this is an effective program. You know, our crime decreased by such and such percentage, our calls for service decreased by a certain percent. But, you know, when you're looking at overall crime, which, of course, we know that crime was decreasing generally across the entire United States at that time as well. If that could really be attributed to the resident officer program, it's hard to tell.
Farmer says it's also unclear whether the entire neighborhood benefits or just the immediate area around the officer.
Are we decreasing the crime rate, or is it just sort of displacing it elsewhere so that, you know, people know they're not going to commit crime on a street where a police officer lives now, but maybe they still will, you know, four blocks over.
Farmer says even without measurable success, resident officer programs show police departments are thinking outside the box. She says any effort to improve police-community relations goes much further than just patrolling neighborhoods. Not that improving those relations is easy. Officer James admits not everyone warms up to him right away. He says he hopes that over the 3 years or more he serves in this role, they'll come around.
Tomorrow's a new day. We'll try this again at some other point. You can talk to me tomorrow, the week later, or whenever, because I'd be surprised. Some people that have kind of closed the door on me, see them later on, they remember me, and we have a great conversation.
James says for now, he's just letting them know he's still there. I'm Dana Vollmer.
Downtown Springfield is jammed with parking problems. Shoppers and tourists complain about a lack of nearby spots. Outdated meters only accept coins, and parking revenue is near its lowest point in the last 8 years. A group of high school students looked into the problem in the fall, and Mary Hansen talked with them and business owners about what can be done.
When Jessica Kasurik moved her salon, Willow and Birch, from Springfield's west side to downtown, there was one question she got.
That was like everyone's first question was, well, where are we going to park? And parking's terrible and this, that, and the other.
I talked with Kasurik while she sewed extensions into a client's hair on the second floor of her salon. Like many others, she says the problem with parking is perception.
In my experience, I've found that it's not terrible. Could it be better? Absolutely. But is there parking options? Yes.
Kasurik takes advantage of two options. She leases spaces for her staff in a lot near the train station and validates parking in the garage under the old state capitol. But the biggest thing she does is talk about it.
Whenever you say, come downtown, this is where our address is, figure it out, that can be very scary if you're not someone who patrons downtown on a regular basis. So we made sure that the communication was there so that it took the fear away from it.
Information about where to park is on the salon's website, and staff make sure clients know about it in calls and texts to confirm appointments. She says this works for her customers, but the city could do more to improve parking. Linda Renahan agrees. She runs Springfield Vintage.
So do you get customers that come in and complain about parking to you?
Oh, come on, you know that answer. I'm so good at giving out quarters.
Renahan has been on a mission to improve downtown parking for months.
In a lot of ways, it's not as bad as it used to be, but when you've got the city of Springfield telling everybody parking sucks and there's been no major work towards helping it, it's now become the reality.
Renahan also sees it as a communication problem.
There's certain blocks in downtown that would say no parking as much as 15 times
in one block.
In one block.
That one block is 5th Street between Adams and Monroe. But Renahan says as you're driving into downtown on 6th Street, just before the old state capitol, there are no signs directing people to the garages.
So we've missed all these opportunities to tell people where to park. We're really good at telling them don't park.
Renahan took a few city officials, including the mayor and some aldermen, on her downtown parking tour. And in the last few weeks, she's seen progress. The city's public works department removed several no parking signs, and they've added 3 signs directing people to the parking garages. Numerous studies have shown there is enough parking in downtown Springfield, and yet the perception problem persists. So what is the solution to downtown parking headaches? A group of high school students in the Sangamon CEO program think they have an answer. Avia Wang is a senior at Springfield High. She says at first they thought of proposing more parking.
But with the data, it was more overwhelmingly that the parking that we already had was not working. So we wanted to focus more on how to improve the meter specifically, because it seemed as if people were the most negatively skewed on that type of parking.
The Sangamon CEO students surveyed more than 500 people last fall and found similar problems to what downtown business owners observed. Confusing signage, not enough information about where to park, and outdated meters. The students recommended a website with information on where to park and a parking app that accepts credit cards. Stickers on existing meters would direct people to use the app, but they could still use coins if they wish. Khazran Nasirpour is also on the Sangamon CEO team. He says they looked at other options, like kiosks.
That's a lot more costly, going from meters to that. It's kind of a big jump. So I think our solution is kind of maybe a transition between those two. It's kind of like in the middle. It's modern, but you're still using the meters.
The city of Springfield sought and received several bids from private sector businesses who say they have the answers to the downtown parking puzzle. But the students hope city officials will remember their comments as the city decides on a solution. A public hearing on downtown parking, as well as new traffic signals and one-way street conversion, is scheduled for February 20th. I'm Mary Hansen.
There's more of Statewide to come. A Central Illinois museum obtains a Lincoln document. We'll have that story. That's on the way next. You're listening to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead, people released from prison or jail can now take advantage of a new housing program in Champaign, but the need for housing remains. Experts say people coming out of prison receive little to no assistance when it comes to finding shelter. We'll have that story. That's on the way. Next up, the McLean County Museum of History has announced the donation of what staff call an invaluable Lincoln document by the Lincoln collector and scholar Guy Fraker. Brianna Groh with member station WGLT attended the public unveiling of the document, a legal pleading written in Lincoln's own hand.
Guy Fraker admits he's a bit of a Lincoln nut. He recalls one incident on a trip with wife Ruth Ann to Italy.
And on the trip, she said, "Well, at least I won't have to hear anything about Abraham Lincoln." So we're touring the square, that beautiful square in Sorrento, and the guide said, "And over there is the hotel where Mary Lincoln stayed when she came in."
So in 2008, when Fraker came across a 1.5-page legal pleading signed by Lincoln in a case he'd never heard of, he was, quote, "floating on air." In the pleading, Lincoln summarizes the case of Funk v. Rutledge, in which he defended Robert H. Rutledge against a complaint by Jesse Funk that Rutledge reneged on a real estate deal. Fraker set out to authenticate the document, but historians in Springfield were also unfamiliar with the case. Despite fears that any proof of the case would have been destroyed in the Great Bloomington Fire of 1900, Fraker was able to verify the document using McLean County Circuit Court records. The pleading dates to the fall of 1851. Judge David Davis presided over the case, ruling in the fall of 1853 in favor of Funk and ordering Rutledge to sell 80 of the disputed 160 acres of land on the southern edge of Downs Township. Fraker says its personal nature is one reason he was so struck by the pleading when he first laid eyes on it.
it was because it's such a beautiful piece of almost art, because it's written in Lincoln's hand. Because it's a pleading, I think he had to have written it while standing in the courthouse to read the document he was responding to. So it shows more of his thought, even, I mean, not, it's not the same depth of thought of, say, the Gettysburg Address, but the Gettysburg Address that we know, that we see, is one, you know, after many drafts that he threw away. Whereas this document, you can see corrections on it, and it shows his thought process as he worked.
A retired Bloomington attorney himself, Fraker touts the document as a testament to the nature of Lincoln's law career.
He was, in fact, a working lawyer, not a cause lawyer.
Fraker says it also represents the real estate cases that made up a significant portion of Lincoln's work, around 1,700 of 5,000 cases. Fraker acquired the document from Marilyn Townley, widow of Judge Wayne Townley Jr., who inherited it from his father, Bloomington attorney and Lincoln collector Wayne Sr. Fraker said no one knows how Wayne Sr. got a hold of it, but he would have acquired it well before World War II. Fraker says Townley told him she felt comfortable passing the document along to him because he'd know what to do with it.
Well, I figured that out over the years, and this is the right way thing to do with it. So that's why it's coming to the museum.
Museum librarian Bill Kemp calls the donation invaluable as a testament to Lincoln's connections to the people and places of McLean County.
And I'm not speaking from a monetary perspective, because it has been appraised. We do know its rough appraisal cost, but that is really inconsequential to us. We're here to preserve and protect objects, items, legal pleadings like this in perpetuity, so it will be around for generations to come. So in many ways, yes, we have ownership of this pleading, but it is really a document for the community as a whole.
Kemp says the donation is just the latest demonstration of Fraker's impact on the community. It's because of Fraker's intense interest in Lincoln scholarship that historians can now say Lincoln spent more time in Bloomington than anywhere else outside his hometown of Springfield during his legal career. I'm Brianna Groh.
The museum will honor Fraker's request to publicly display the Lincoln pleading at least once a year, on or around the time of Lincoln's birthday. Museum visitors can also request to view the document. And by the way, the Robert Rutledge mentioned in the legal dispute was the cousin of Lincoln's first love, Anne Rutledge of New Salem. Western Illinois University says it will receive state dollars to restart a long-desired and long-delayed project on the Macomb campus. Rich Egger tells us more.
The university says the Illinois Capital Development Board will release $8.9 million for the Center for Performing Arts. Interim Provost Billy Clow says the money will let WIU update architectural drawings.
It's been, you know, close to 5 years now since we've really had a chance to update things and look. We have to go back through and double check code, you know, electrical, plumbing, all that sort of thing, you know, manufacturing. I mean, a lot of the lighting fixtures have probably changed, carpets, all those things have to be reconsidered and looked at before we can move forward and get the documents ready for bid. So it shouldn't take us very long. But again, even the architects had been shelved for 5 years, and so they have to re-engage their team and all the consultants, acoustical consultants and all those types of folks, to get us back up to speed.
Well, at one time, the project did go out for bid, and the state rejected the bids, correct?
Correct. There only one bid came in on time. There were two contractors at that meeting, one whose date stamp, you know, they have a specific time they have to put their bid in. They were 11 seconds late, and the clerk said, "You're late. Thank you," and handed them back their documents after they time-stamped it. The other one came in after the fact as well. And so we never actually got a really good sense of what the bid project would have been.
The price of construction increases over time, so have you had to scale back what you want to do?
Well, there's some escalation that's been built into it. So construction costs escalate over the 5 years. And so there's a basic formula that they utilize, and I don't know what that formula is specifically, but I do know that they've looked at what it would have taken to get us to that base package that was proposed, you know, 14-ish years ago now. And so that's where we will start. Once the architects and the contractors get it put together, we'll take a look at it and see if we have to scale back anything. We've got some options if we need to here and there. We can go from, you know, the top of the line things. You know, the architects originally, when they built this thing, everything was, you know, the best you could get in the world. I'm not certain that we have to have all of those things. Some of it was just decoration, as it were. We've cut a lot of that stuff out. We want a good, solid, state-of-the-art building that's the highlight of the state of Illinois and can move us all forward.
There was a ceremonial groundbreaking 9 years ago, maybe. Once actual construction starts, how long will it take to build this?
So, well, the total project is scheduled to be around 30 months. So the construction part of it should take about 2 years. So it all just depends on when the final okay is given to us, when we start moving forward, when the bids come in, et cetera. The original groundbreaking happened before I even worked at Western. The giant presenting of the check that happened then with Governor Quinn was right before the election there. And then after his loss and Governor Rauner took over, then that's when the building was suspended at the time. Once we get to that point where we see some shovels in the ground, I think is where all of us are going to feel comfortable that something is moving forward.
You're confident this is going to happen?
I'm as confident as I have been in the last 8 years.
Billy Clough is the Dean of the College of Fine Arts and Communication at Western Illinois University. He's also the school's interim provost. Clough says the Center for Performing Arts will include a concert hall, two smaller theaters, rehearsal rooms, and classrooms. Planning for the building dates back to the 1970s. When Western hosted the groundbreaking ceremony in 2011, the estimated cost was $68 million. That's $21 million less than the current estimate. Rich Ugger reporting.
You're listening to Statewide. Over 13 million American households get their drinking water from private wells, yet well owners aren't required to test their water quality by state or federal agencies. That means dangerous contamination can go unchecked for years. But as Christina Stella reports for Harvest Public Media, that blind spot has led to a push in training communities to test their own water supplies.
It's first period at Freeman High in the southeastern town of Adams, Nebraska. A handful of seniors from the school's Future Farmers of America Club huddle around a spread of plastic bottles and little glass test tubes. Addison Dorn braved the Midwestern cold the night before to collect water samples from her family's well. In a minute, they'll test it for contamination, like too many nitrates.
Yeah, it usually gets in well water around here because of fertilizers. Nitrogen is found in fertilizers, and so when there's like a lot of rain or irrigation, it can sometimes seep into your groundwater, which will go into your well.
Polluted waters put many rural communities at risk for long-term health complications, like cancer, birth defects. A 2018 National Institute of Health study suggested about a quarter of wells in agricultural communities aren't safe to drink from because of high nitrate levels. That's partly why Tony Jensen, Freeman's agriculture teacher and FFA sponsor, enrolled the school in the University of Nebraska-Lincoln's Know Your Well program.
I don't think a lot of people realize that you should get it tested as often as you should. And, you know, so it's kind of also that educational component for the community.
The Citizen Science Program places scientists in classrooms across the state to teach young people how to spot unsafe drinking water. Mary Skopek, who runs the University of Iowa's Lakeside Laboratory, says citizen science was historically for people privileged enough to do it as a hobby. Think Sir Isaac Newton or Charles Darwin.
But I'd say within the last 20 years, for sure, there's been this strong upswing in folks that wouldn't identify themselves as scientists who care about the environment.
She supervised a similar program in Iowa for 10 years, which trained the public to test local streams and creeks. At its peak, Skopek's team had 5,000 volunteers.
After a few years, word of mouth was so strong that we didn't have to advertise at all.
Harry Heifer, who lives just south of Lincoln, has volunteered for a few well testing programs over the years. He says ag communities play a critical role in testing their water quality.
But I think the concept of it is great because, you know, government can't go out there and test every well and get information from it. And even now, the city county health department likely has records when the well's first put in, but after that, there's no record of what happens to the water.
Heifer has watched his nitrate levels climb up to 18 parts per million over the years. He eventually warned his neighbors, some of whom have young children. That's exactly the kind of conversation the Know Your Well program hopes for, by teaching younger people to be aware of water issues. Back at Freeman High, Addison's friend Rayanne shows her how to mix the well water with a reactant in a sample tube. The pinker it turns, the higher the nitrate content.
And then you just let it sit, and then color development will happen over time.
So this is pretty easy.
Yeah.
A few minutes later, the group is surprised to see the tube turn cotton candy pink.
We have a lot of nitrate, what we found out.
High levels.
Yeah, high levels of nitrate, like 10 to 14.
Thankfully, Dorn won't be drinking from that well. It's used for irrigation. But Skopek thinks discoveries like these are important, especially in a classroom setting, because they reinforce trust in the scientific process. She's also found that communities are less likely to discuss solutions, like working to use fertilizer more precisely or installing a home filtration system, if they can't see for themselves that they have a problem.
And I think that's really, really powerful because most people hated science when they went through it in school because they saw it as a test, right or wrong answer, as opposed to a process of gathering and understanding information.
In Skopek's view, a pink test tube doesn't have to feel like a gotcha moment. It can just as easily be the start of a life-saving conversation. I'm Christina Stella.
People released from prison or jail can now take advantage of a new housing program in Champaign. The program also aims to help residents find jobs and health care. And as Illinois Newsroom's Lee Gaines reports, research shows there's a massive need for supportive housing for people coming out of Illinois prisons, but that need is largely unaddressed.
Every year, 28,000 people are released from Illinois prisons. Now, four of them will live in a modest five-bedroom home in a Champaign residential neighborhood. Vincent Andujo gives me a tour of the place.
And so this is one of the rooms. We can go next door and see. Everyone you see with a bed, with a carpet and a dresser and a nightstand and all that. I think that is the standard.
But residents get more than just a bed and a dresser. These men will get a chance to fulfill their goals. In fact, the house already has its first resident. He didn't want to talk to me for this story. The Champaign Group First Followers runs the house. Many of the people supporting the residents also spent time in prison. They provide help with writing a resume or tutoring. Tamika Davis Nunez says that would have helped her. Davis Nunez spent 8 years in prison. She was released in 2008. Like many others, she ended up at a halfway house.
And so that was like the scariest moments of my life because I had nothing and nobody to guide me.
Davis Nunez now works for First Followers, and she's tutoring the home's first resident. Davis Nunez says that kind of support is key to a successful reentry.
I don't think that a person that's done 25 years could ever even think about getting acclimated back into society without the help, without the support. If you do not have support, there is no way. That's why a lot of people end up going back to prison.
Experts agree. Research shows providing supportive housing for people leaving prison or jail could save Illinois more than $100 million per year because fewer people would return to prison. Jennifer Vollenkatz says most people leaving prison have to figure out housing on their own.
And they're walking out the door typically with, you know, a bus ticket and $10 and the clothes on their back that they got issued from the prison as they were released.
Vollenkatz is the executive director of the John Howard Association, an Illinois prison watchdog group. Nearly 40% of people who leave Illinois prisons return within 3 years. One reason, there's not enough housing and support. Vollenkatz says it's cheaper to house people outside of prison.
So anytime we can start investing in helping people be successful outside of prison, you know, long-term, we're saving money.
Vollenkatz says that while there are upfront costs associated with this kind of housing, it's worth it. James Kilgore agrees. He's co-founder of the First Followers Group in Champaign. Kilgore knows this new facility will hardly make a dent in the number of homes needed. But he says that's not really the point. People have to apply to live in this house, and there are some specific requirements. Kilgore says they're looking for people with plans and goals for their future.
We're trying to build, you know, a smallish kind of cohort of people who can have an impact well beyond their numbers.
James Kilgore says if they find the right residents, the men will make the case for investment in programs like this. Kilgore spent time in prison, and he knows there are people behind bars with dreams. Now he wants to help with the support they need to make at least some part of those dreams come true. I'm Lee Gaines, Illinois Newsroom.
Stick around for more of Statewide. We'll hear from some of the Republicans running to take on Democrat Dick Durbin in this year's U.S. Senate race. That's just ahead. And be sure to check out our website at statewideshow.com. You can find links to the stories you hear each week. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, there's a new approach to teaching PE in schools. And flowers fade, but there are more permanent ways to express love. We'll hear what some couples did recently for Valentine's Day. That's all ahead on Statewide. President Donald Trump is unopposed in next month's Republican primary, but Illinois Republican voters still have some decisions to make. Five GOP candidates are vying for the right to challenge the incumbent Democratic U.S. Senator Dick Durbin come November. Joe Deacon reports several of them made a recent stop in Bloomington Normal.
Three candidates made their stump speeches in Bloomington trying to convince McLean County Republicans they have the best shot to unseat the entrenched Durbin. The appearance was part of a broader McLean County Republican primary review. Tom Tarter, a Springfield cancer surgeon, is making health care a focal point of his campaign. He says President Trump has begun a move to lower health care costs with a pricing transparency rule,
which will create competition in the health care marketplace and reduce the cost of care for most Americans. But he can't do it alone. He needs help from me. There is no senatorial candidate, including Dick Durbin, who has more experience and who is more authoritative on U.S. healthcare policy than me.
Though Tarter is a surgeon and not a policy scholar, he says he has a white paper at his website that details what he calls common sense solution to reducing costs. Tarter says he also wants to help fix a broken immigration system.
The Democrats don't want a wall because walls are effective. They are an open border party. I'm not. And the Republicans are not. So we want to complete the wall. We also want technology. We want more CBP officers. We want family detention centers.
Tarter says he has the financial support that has put him a step ahead of his competition.
Even in the third quarter of fundraising, I raised the most money. I raised the most money in the fourth quarter. I have raised the most money overall. I've done statewide polling, and I've hired an experienced political team. I'm far ahead of the other candidates, and that's why I'm going to be the nominee.
One of Tarter's opponents is a Navy veteran and former police officer from Belleville. Peggy Hubbard says she is a difficult matchup for the incumbent Durbin.
I'm pretty much the quintessential candidate that he never wants to face. He was always used to running against white males, older males, but he never had to go up against a minority woman.
Hubbard says the fact that she is a former Democrat also brings a new vibe to the campaign. Hubbard says she lost a brother in gang shooting and her personal experience stands in stark contrast to the other Republican candidates.
Not to throw my opponents under the bus, but they're really out of touch with what's going on in the inner city with the gang violence and gun violence. These gentlemen never had to face some of the hardships that I had to face in life. Growing up in the inner city, growing up poor, growing up in the Democratic Party.
Hubbard also points to the personal wealth of her rivals as a reason she is a better choice for GOP voters. She says common citizens can relate better to her life experience than the rest of the field.
I don't think they touch a lot of the angst of what we are going through as actual Illinoisans, as actual Americans. We need somebody that actually lived like us in order to understand the problems that we're facing in our communities as well as in our country.
Like Hubbard, the third candidate is also a former Democrat. Mark Curran makes his pitch to McLean County Republicans by saying he's the only person in the field to have held elective office. Curran is a former Lake County sheriff.
You know, with me, there's less of a roll of the dice. You know, I've been vetted. People know what I stand for. They've seen the record. They've seen me defend liberty. They've seen me defend issues like life. They've seen that I was somebody that defended the Second Amendment, believed deeply in it.
Curran says one of his ideas to fix health care is to incentivize healthy behavior through rebates for not smoking or lower rates for healthy eating habits. He also points to what he says is a systemic problem in the way government supports healthcare for low-income people.
There's also a lot of fraud in Medicaid and even in Medicare, that eats up a lot of the tax dollars that are supposed to be going there. So having been a longtime prosecutor as well, that's something that I'd look into so that the people that actually need it are getting those services.
Democrats tend to criticize big business as a tool of the right, but Curran says the opposite is true. He points to Amazon's donations to Democratic candidates and promises to combat both socialism and what he calls crony capitalism.
Historically, the biggest corporations have owned the left, and they've had an unfair advantage over small businesses. So I'm somebody that whose economic view or vision is to help small businesses, more entrepreneurs, less regulation, less taxation.
Curran says the nation does not need more big business mergers. He says government should let small businesses compete rather than have the big box stores come to town. Two other Republican candidates for U.S. Senate in Illinois did not attend the McLean County GOP session. They are Glenview businessman Casey Klebeck and Burr Ridge physician Robert Marshall. I'm Joe Deacon.
And one of those Republican U.S. Senate candidates also says she brought a gun and three ammo clips into a suburban Chicago high school during a student-organized candidates forum a week ago. Peggy Hubbard told audience members at another forum in Washington, Illinois this week how she was admitted into Hinsdale Central High School as an example of lapses in school safety, which she says are widespread in less urban areas.
And it had a sticker that says, no guns. I walked into school, I gave the lady my concealed carry card. Gave her my card, she looked at it, gave me a sticker, I walked in.
A Hinsdale district spokesman says they've contacted police about the alleged incident. The district maintains if Hubbard did bring a gun into the school, it was not only illegal, but dangerous and irresponsible. The district says students and staff go through active shooter drills, and both high schools are outfitted with command centers for such an incident. The primary election is set for March 17th. Early voting is already underway. This is Statewide. Physical education is not just running the mile and push-ups anymore. Technology is crafting the next generation of gym class, while teachers focus more on mental health than getting fit. Peter Medlin explains.
When you think of PE class, what's the vision in your head? Are you climbing a rope? Is it hoping not to get picked last in dodgeball? Maybe it makes you think of a gym class scene in a movie.
Physical education in this school is a disgrace. I mean, standing in line for 40 minutes is hardly aerobically effective. I doubt I've worked off the calories in a stick of carefree gum.
That's what physical education felt like for a lot of people.
There was definitely a rope that had to be climbed.
That's Mike Graham. He's taught for over 20 years. He's at Williamsburg Elementary in Geneva now. Last year, he was named the Illinois Elementary PE Teacher of the Year. And he says PE has evolved quite a bit since he started. For one, physical fitness isn't the goal, especially at his K-5 grade levels.
You're not going to make these, you know, fitness freaks out of these kids by my two-day-a-week program.
He believes physical education in 2020 strives to be about health, both physical and social-emotional. That's why in Graham's gym, there's a giant poster hung on the wall that says,
I see you, I care about you, I want you to succeed.
He got the sign idea from Twitter. He's been active on social media for years, building a network of other teachers. In many schools, like Graham's, he's the only PE teacher, so it's easy to fall into a routine.
Getting them to shift the whole paradigm and flip it upside down and say, like this is another classroom. My gym is the biggest classroom in the school, and we're here, we're learning things. And if the kids leave and don't know why, then I'm just a glorified, activity director.
Graham has a website where he curates his class and keeps parents up to date. He also has a YouTube channel sharing his lessons. Over in Sycamore, Shelley Tranchita teaches high school PE. She also has a YouTube channel where she and her club of Cheetah Girls, a nod to her last name, make health and fitness videos.
So we're going to be doing 5 1-minute workouts. And
their health and wellness club produces a podcast, too.
Well, I'm excited to have our first podcast here talking about mental health, suicide awareness.
May I have your attention,
please? We are in a school,
GSA,
so we're going to hear things like that.
Tranchita and a student have health-related conversations with other students and teachers. And she says it's time to stop seeing physical education as limited to physical.
I think just as the research comes through and as we learn more, the physical is the mental and the mental is the physical, and they hold hands and they're tied together.
Her mind and body fitness class is an exercise in that concept. Sometimes it's an up-tempo workout. Sometimes they venture into breathing and meditation.
I do some chanting meditations, which the first time we do it, everyone looks at me like I have, you know, five heads. But then the feedback that I get from that is, oh my gosh, let's do it again. I felt amazing afterwards.
Back in 2017, Illinois rescinded its daily PE requirement. Several bills since have pushed for a mandatory minutes minimum that aligns with national standards, but it's failed to find legislative footing. Shape America sets those standards for teaching PE. Michelle Carter is a senior program manager. She says there are still some states where you can teach PE without a specific content area credential or certification.
It definitely is one of the factors that play into why physical education might not be considered an academic subject or that it's not as essential as the other subjects.
It's also undeniable that PE can be a uniquely vulnerable space in a school. Bullying can wreck a student's interest in PE and stop them from building the healthy habits teachers aim for. Advocates also rail against widespread PE exemptions for kids involved with sports or other extracurriculars. Rob Bisegli is the CEO of Action for Healthy Kids. They're a Chicago-based nonprofit providing grants and supporting schools and parents implementing health programs.
I think really saying to ourselves, okay, I can't remove all these different stressors in their lives, but I can help them build the capacity to deal with them when they come down the pike. And I think that's really important.
And both Bisegli and the others agree PE teachers are in a prime position to help as students try to develop healthy kids on the inside and out. I'm Peter Medlin.
Some use flowers or chocolates to say I love you on Valentine's Day, but some want to express themselves with something a little more permanent. And this year, Lauren Frost, with member station WBEZ, visited a tattoo parlor in Chicago's Uptown neighborhood and met some people memorializing their relationship in ink.
Paul Colorifici owns this shop. It's called the Tattoo Factory.
Today it's really cold. It's like 0 degrees, so all the poor Valentine celebrators are having a hard time. But we're moving along. People are coming in. They're getting tattoos. They're happy. A lot of little hearts and things like that. A lot of ways. Just sometimes they don't get a Valentine's tattoo. They just get a tattoo on Valentine's Day so they can remember the occasion.
Valentine's Day is my favorite holiday. Like, love is just the most universal thing ever.
So that's Colleen Kennedy. She's here with her best friend, Larkin Magar.
So we're going to get a red snake, more of a serpent, though, a little more badass than a snake. But we're going to get matching red serpents because it makes us look tough.
Yeah.
Exactly. Don't mess with us.
Oh, my God, Larkin, it looks so good.
I could not have pictured it better.
Okay, how'd it go for you?
It went great. I'm happy with my tattoo, you know? Got up with my best friend, so I can't complain.
Wow. Ready for this, man?
I don't think I'm
Yeah, you are. This is going to be fun.
That slightly nervous voice is Chauncey Smith. He's here with his girlfriend, Kinga Sapinska.
I got my girlfriend's name on my hand, K-I-N-G-A, Kinga.
But he tells me he's not a huge believer in Valentine's Day.
Well, if I'm being honest, I've never ever had a girlfriend, so I never ever had a Valentine's Day. So, and I'm a big, like I said, I'm a big advocate that Valentine's Day is a made-up holiday anyway. So, it's a normal day for me, but it was I liked the day. I enjoyed the day. You know, it was a very enjoyable day. She did a little surprise for me earlier or whatever, so.
What did you do?
Oh, I, like, wrote him in like, a little mailbox, like, all the things that I love about him. So that was pretty cool.
And that didn't make you like Valentine's Day a little more?
It did. Like, to come home to that, yeah. That's what I said. I mean, yeah, I definitely enjoyed the day. Maybe I now got to reassess my thinking behind
Valentine's
Day. But
if you're in the right relationship, like, Valentine's Day is every day. So, yeah, for us, it's a regular day. Like, we always do, like, little stuff like that.
And in case that wasn't heartwarming enough,
I'm in Minnesota. My daughter's in Florida. She flew up, and she wanted to get a matching tattoo with me.
That's Deborah Korb.
This is our Valentine's together. Mom and daughter tattoos matching.
That's so nice. How do you feel like it ranks as far as Valentine's Day is?
You know, it's definitely one of the most special because she said she wanted to do it, but then people can chicken out when there's that moment of actually doing it. So I'm really happy. My heart is just overflowing with joy that, you know, my adult child wants a tattoo like mine.
A
Across the room, Anastasia Ladley is getting the tattoo.
That's it?
That's it.
Aww. It was good. I managed to test my pain tolerance. It was good. Me and Mama have the matching tattoos now, so love you, Mom.
Love you, Anastasia.
Lauren Frost, WBEZ News.
That's it for this week statewide. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back at this time next week with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. If you missed any of this episode or past episodes, they're available at statewideshow.com. You can also get our weekly podcast through the NPR One app. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.